Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. So, the Fed reminded us last week that it won't let interest rates stay near zero forever. Just a little bump got the world's attention. Low interest rates have kept the housing market from completely tanking, kept the banks in business, helped to keep the economy afloat. But for people maybe retired, dependent on interest payments for income, it's been tough. This hour, On Point, interest rates and the economic path we're on. You can join the conversation. Have interest rates near zero been a blessing or a curse for you, for your business? Is the economy strong enough now for them to bump up? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll talk with former Republican Senator from Wyoming, Alan Simpson, who's just been named co-chair of President Obama's new commission to tackle the national deficit. Right now, to look at interest rates and the economy, I'm joined by Peter Coy, economics editor at Bloomberg Business Week. Peter Coy, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks very much for having me on.
And from Pittsburgh and the Carnegie Mellon Tepper School of Business, we're joined by Marvin Goodfriend, professor of economics. Welcome, Marvin Goodfriend.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Peter, first to you. Tell us, what exactly did the Fed do last week?
They raised the discount rate, which is not the most important rate in the economy. Mm-hmm. It's the one that is occasionally used by banks. If they can't get money elsewhere, they can borrow directly from the Fed. Now, that was used quite a bit during the crisis. But since the crisis has passed and we're kind of just into a generic slump, there's been very little borrowing done through the discount window. So that was mostly a symbolic move, withdrawing of emergency measures that were really not being used much anymore.
Marvin Goodfriend, so it's just up from 0.5%, this discount rate, 0.50 to 0.75. It's very tiny. It's just symbolic. Why did they do it, Professor?
Well, the Fed is trying to get the public's attention because it knows that at some point in the coming year, the Fed will have to move interest rates farther away from zero. And it needs to initiate a public discussion, which is exactly what's happening here. This is exactly what the Fed wants to have happen, so people can prepare for that moment and understand why the Fed needs to do this and understand some good things will happen out of this as well. And I'm sure we'll get to that later.
Why does it need to move away from these zero, near zero rates we've had? Why?
Well, zero rates are extremely stimulative, and they were, as you pointed out at the early part of the show, that these rates were put in place to keep the economy afloat. And, you know, we've come out of this recession in a technical sense with growth last quarter being in the order of 4 or 5 percentage points. Growth won't stay that high, but the Fed is confident that we will slowly emerge from the recession, and it wants to express its confidence today or last week in the form of raising the short rate and beginning this conversation about what we can look forward to.
Peter, I guess it's about staving off the threat of inflation if and when the economy starts to gain steam. But, you know, only in the last couple of weeks when the markets were so wobbly and people were looking at deficits all over the world, in the euro and Greece and everything else, lots of people were saying maybe we're in for a double dip here. Maybe we're not on that road to inflation and recovery.
Right. And that's why the Fed is not raising the much more important federal funds rate. It's raising the discount rate again as a symbolic measure. Mm-hmm. But overall, the most important rates in the economy remain just about as close to zero as you can get. You know, we're at less than 0.25% now on the federal funds rate, which is the rate at which banks lend to each other for overnight loans.
This has been the longest super low rate chapter in, I think, the history of the Fed, Peter.
It is. I mean, it's just really unprecedented to have rates this low. And the irony is that there are some people who think they're too high. You know, how could it be that zero is too high? And yet that is exactly what many economists are saying, that if the Fed could magically lower rates below zero, it might want to do so at a time like this.
Well, in fact, you've written recently, Peter, there is, in effect, a way to do that. If they can crank up some inflation, it makes low interest rates even lower, makes them even negative. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing what Professor Goodfriend has to say about this later
okay.
on. But let me take a first crack. So the concept is the difference between the nominal rate, which is the one you see in the headlines, versus the real rate, which is the interest rate after taking inflation into account.
This is not actually so hard for people to understand if they're living on fixed incomes and interest incomes. If they if they're getting 1% or less on their savings or their CD, and and inflation is 2 or 3 or 4% at the supermarket, people know this.
Well, that's right. You just summed it up pretty well. And yet sometimes the economy might actually need the jolt that it can get from a negative real interest rate in order to get going again. You know, encourage consumers to borrow, encourage businesses to borrow for investment, and so on. And there are various rules of thumb that would indicate that you might want a negative real interest rate of as much as 5%, you know, extremely negative, and we're not there at this stage.
But you wrote in January, and I'll take it to Professor Goodfriend, but you wrote in January, the solution is obvious. The Fed needs to kind of crank up inflation up to 6%, hold inflation rates, interest rates low, make it, in a sense, paying people to borrow money, because at that time, I guess, Peter, you were and others were concerned that the recovery wasn't steady enough. It wasn't for real. It wasn't solid.
Well, I think that 6% number, I guess I wrote that, but I don't actually wouldn't stick to a prediction of saying that the inflation rate should go to 6%. I think that'd be a mistake. What you do want to get the economy going, and there are reputable people who would say that our target for inflation should be higher than it is now, but I don't think that many people would actually advocate 6%. That was maybe more of a theoretical
discussion. In fairness, you said maybe not all the way to 6%, but that sounds pretty close. Marvin Goodfriend, how do you look at it? Peter Coy's still been warning about the possibility of deflation. A deflationary spiral is very hard to break. Of course, inflation is a tiger, too. how do you see this moment we're at?
Well, I've been enjoying this conversation because I've been thinking about this quite a lot over the last few years. Mm. I think there's no question the logic of what Peter is saying makes sense. However, I think there's countervailing forces, issues that need to be put in place here. First of all, the Fed has expanded its balance sheet by $1 trillion in the past year and has the capacity to do much more. It's not as if the Fed is completely out of gas when interest rates are zero, and I believe the Fed would be willing to do that if there was the prospect of deflation if the prospect of deflation becomes a serious issue in the coming months.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not really out of gas. There's no reason, I think, to try to move inflation up in order to move the real interest rate down and hurt many people who are living on interest income at this point.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we're not out of gas. The Fed has a balance sheet policy. It can literally create money and make loans to whoever it wants to do to stimulate the economy if we get into a deflationary situation. I would like to point out, though, that while people had been concerned, and I was one of them, of the possibility of deflation, it looks like the doubling of the size of the Fed balance sheet from $1 trillion to $2 trillion and plus has staved off the prospect of a serious deflation for the time being.
You mean they're pumping money into the economy when you say their balance sheet doubling?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so I think the Fed has been worried about just the kind of thing we're talking about in the last few minutes and still has its eye on the ball, and I don't think we'll allow that to happen. So I think we can hold the line on inflation, on the sort of the tolerance zone or comfort zone on inflation, somewhere in the 2-3% range, and not have to imagine moving it up much higher, which, as we all agree, would be devastating for people on fixed incomes.
And those people have felt the pain of this thing. In a way, part of the recovery, you could make the argument, has been built on the back of the retired and others on fixed incomes. Those very low rates give the banks money to play with. We've got some of the folks very aware of that calling in already. Harrisonburg, Virginia. Rick, you're on the air.
I think that Bernanke's low rates are holding us in recession because the banks can go to the discount window and borrow and then buy treasuries and make their interest rates spread without dealing with any people. They don't have any risk and no cost.
And so maybe that's all they do. Peter Coy, how about it? If the banks can make money just by getting these super low rates and then take it to T-bills and make a nice margin at no risk, is that why we don't have the lending we need to get this economy back in gear?
That is a very astute caller. That's an extremely good observation, and it is a problem. I think the Fed's aware of it. It's very disappointing when the banks just take advantage of their low borrowing costs to earn a nice spread by putting it all into treasuries, which is really not what's most needed now. You'd like to see loans going out to Main Street. It's just that the Fed has only a few blunt instruments to use. It's doing what it can, and it's not getting exactly the results it might prefer.
Well, Marvin, though, I do have the sense that part of the response to this recession, the Great Recession, whatever, has come at the expense of American retirees. I mean, their low interest rates have been a big opportunity for banks.
Well, there's no question that low interest rates are an opportunity for banks to a degree, although remember, the banks did not really do that well for the last couple of years. They've taken huge losses. They've had to replenish their capital.
But haven't retirees, in effect, helped them do that here by making nothing on their money for the last year?
That's absolutely true, and I'd like to get to a related point, which is that if you're retired and if you have positioned yourself as I think people, what I would recommend and what people I think know about, you want to avoid interest rate risk, which is you don't want to have your retirement assets in a position to be subject to short-term interest rate fluctuations. The ideal would be to have either annuities or long-term government bonds that pay coupons so that you're not subject to the short-term movements in interest rates that the Fed needs to move around in order to stabilize the whole system.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this time about the economy and interest rates and the path we are on now. Peter Coy is with us from New York, economics editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. Marvin Goodfriend is here from Pittsburgh, professor of economics, chairman of the Center for Public Policy at Carnegie Mellon's Tepper School of Business. Peter, you've still been warning very recently that deflation might be the risk. Why?
Well, in the most recent report on the Consumer Price Index, we actually had a decline in the core index. That's the one that excludes food and energy prices, which are very volatile. And it fell for the first time since 1982. This indicates that there's not a lot of demand in the economy because obviously supply and demand is what determines prices. When demand is weak and there's plenty of supply, prices tend to fall, and that's exactly what happened, which indicates that the economy is still very weak. And you can just look around and see why. Unemployment is still almost 10%, and long-term unemployment is just at record levels, the percentage of people who are out of work who have been out of work for half a year or more. And then look around at business. The utilization of manufacturing capacities remains extremely low. In other words, a lot of idle factory assembly lines and so on. And then the housing market. Look at the housing market. There's some signs of life, and yet still, housing sales at a very low level, prices down. Many, many people are underwater on their mortgages. They're scared to death that they wouldn't be able to sell if they needed to sell. They're sort of hanging on by their fingernails. Mm-hmm. They're trying to save more. Instead of spending, people are saving, which overall, of course, is a good thing in the long term. But in the short term, it's very bad for economic demand.
So it could go either way. You have written in a more worried way about deflation than inflation. Is it more difficult or dangerous somehow? Why?
It is more dangerous because inflation, we've had a lot of experience with it, too much experience with it. We know what to do when there's inflation. What we do is we raise interest rates, and that tends to cool off the economy and slow demand. And But when you have deflation, as we've been discussing, you can only get interest rates down to zero, and then you've hit that limit. Professor Goodfriend correctly observed that there are other things you can do, such as expand the Fed's balance sheet, but those are very weak, flimsy levers that don't produce the results you might want, certainly not quickly. And you can get into a downward spiral. What happens is that people owe money in fixed amounts, say $1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. Their pay goes down, and that $1,000 starts to loom larger and larger.
They still owe it.
Mm-hmm. They still owe it. They default on it. Mm-hmm. Then the bank that they owed the money to goes under, and down we go.
Marvin Goodfriend, I think you're more worried about inflation. Does that mean you're confident we've turned the corner and that's the risk?
Well, I'm a little more confident that we will stave off a deflation. I mean, I'd like to point out that before people get terribly worried, the year-over-year core price index is still up by about 1%. Mm. So we have some way to go before it actually goes negative. And I don't believe that's going to happen, as I say, because the Fed does have the capacity to literally print money. Now, if the Fed goes about printing money with abandon, then it's hard for me to imagine that prices will not stabilize and eventually move up. And that's why I'm fairly confident that the Fed will be able to control the deflation risk going forward, given what we've seen in the past year. As I say, about a year ago, I was more concerned about deflation than I was about inflation. I'm a little more optimistic, probably where the Fed is now, than maybe Peter is. But I do want to make one other point. One of the reasons the Fed needs to move short rates up at some point this year or early next year, that is this federal funds rate that we've been talking about, the meaningful rate, is to hold long-term rates down. And that's the point I want to make. It's so important. Long-term interest rates, which are the rates that the economy really cares about, medium and long-term rates, because those are the rates that people borrow at, those are the rates people like to save in. Long-term rates are subject to what we call inflation premia. People look out 5, 10, 15 years, and they ask, if I'm going to lend somebody money over that term, what kind of inflation protection do I need for that kind of loan? With ultra-easy interest rate policy or monetary policy today, there are many, many people who are wondering, what kind of inflation premium do I need to include if I'm going to lend money to people? For example, if I'm going to lend money to the government for 20 or 30 years, if I'm going to lend money to businesses for 10 or 20 years.
But is there evidence they're jacking up the rates they're lending at because of fear of inflation? I mean, mortgage rates are long-term, and they're still quite low.
Right. There's no evidence yet. But the point is that monetary policy works with a lag, and there's kind of a glass ceiling somewhere out there, not probably in the next 6 months, not probably in the next year, but somewhere out there in the next 2 or 3 years, the markets are going to get nervous about this, and there's a kind of a glass ceiling, what we call in the business a potential collapse of credibility for low inflation out 10 years or so. And the Fed needs to protect itself against that, and that's why it started this conversation today or last week.
Tough to know for individual little savers to know what to do in this kind of environment. Niagara Falls, New York. Mark, you're on the air, Mark.
Hi, thank you. I'm sort of confused. I thought the whole crisis that we have now was based on excessively easy credit, and yet we got like these super low, virtually zero interest rates. And I also thought that part of the problem with the American economy was that we don't save enough. But who's going to save if you're getting like
nothing,
breaking even if you count inflation or less?
Yeah. Good points, Peter Coy. What do you say to Mark?
Well, that's all very true. It's can't deny that a big part of the problem we had was overly easy credit. It wasn't just the interest rates, though. It was also the standards of lending, the idea of no money down for a mortgage. So rate played an effect in it, but also just lax regulation. And the point of Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chairman, is that stop blaming him for keeping rates low and start focusing more on the vast group of people who are responsible for the sloppy credit practices. That would include the lending officers at banks. That would include the credit rating agencies like Standard & Poor's and Moody's. And the buyers of the mortgage-backed securities who just, you know, closed their eyes and bought. So there was a reason that rates were that low. There was a fear after the 2001 recession that the economy was exceptionally weak and that we wanted to stimulate it. It could be that rates were kept too low for too long, but that was not the sole problem. So bringing it forward to our current situation, yes, low rates may have gotten us into this problem, but that doesn't mean that raising rates now would be the right solution. It actually there's quite a wide spectrum of economists, including some pretty serious inflation hawks, who nevertheless believe that keeping rates low, at least for now, is probably the right medicine.
I want to hear from a couple of our listeners. We've got people fired up about this. From this angle, here's Larry on the web, Peter and Marvin, says, you know, the banks are getting free money from the Fed, turning around, buying Treasury notes and being paid interest on them. They're not paying out any interest, you know, sort of worthy of the name, to the American people in their savings accounts. They're charging upwards of 30% interest on credit cards. Larry says they're robbing the American people blind, and Congress does nothing to stop them. Let's get a call from Boston and John. John, you're on the air.
Yeah, I want to follow up with that. It's disgusting that anybody would say how bad the banks have it, that the banks can't afford to pay more than a small percentage. If they can afford to charge you and me 30% on our credit card, they can surely afford to pay you and me more than 1 or 2% on our savings saving and on the money that they're getting from the bank we owned called the U.S. government.
John, we got it. Certainly people trying to save and make something on those savings might feel that way, especially if you're older and count on some kind of income from whatever little nest egg you've got. But Savannah, Georgia, Fred, you're on the air.
I'm so glad that somebody finally addressed this issue. I think that I followed the plan for the American dream, and I think I did it pretty well.
How'd you do it, Fred?
Well, I worked all my life. There was never a time that I wasn't employed, never collected a nickel of unemployment or any other thing. And now, you know, I'm supposed to be embarrassed that I'm on what's called an entitlement, like Medicare. But the bottom line is I stashed away enough money so that in any normal perspective, you could say that I would have a reasonable amount of interest income coming in, and now all that's happening is that I'm attacking the principal, and I have to refocus the whole plan and can't live the life that somebody promised me I'd live if I followed through on these things.
Because you're not making enough of an interest return on your nest egg to have a retirement. You've got to get into the main principal itself.
Exactly, and the banks are making plenty of money. You can bet they're making plenty of money. There's only two things I have to say that look, this is one of those things like nursing homes that are filled with old people. We dump our old people someplace and we forget about what their contribution was. Well, there's a big bunch of them called the baby boomers coming along who are going to bite somebody in the butt pretty soon. And I've begun the process myself by moving every nickel that I have in any kind of a debt obligation or any kind of a saving obligation to small local community lenders and banks, and I'm doing a little better on interest rates, and I'm dumping the big ones,
but it's still
big ones.
Yeah, but it's still tough, and we know it. Fred, thanks for your call from Savannah. Marvin Goodfriend, you know you can multiply that story times millions and millions of people, couples who have saved and now can't live off their savings.
Well, absolutely. I'd like to tell a story which is exactly to this point. I think it's a travesty what's happening, and here's a story I'd like to tell. My father retired in the late 1970s, and he had his life savings in long-term government bonds. He was taught to do that as a safe long-term investment because the government's credit, U.S. government's credit worthiness was good at the time. He said that's the safest place to put your money. Don't go to financial markets. Don't try to be a pig. Just use the government. Of course, older people now, and everybody knows what happened. Inflation reduced the value of his lifetime savings by about half. And so when he died and transferred his lifetime savings to my mother, she was left with about half of what he had or what he had hoped she would have. So what did she do? And bear with me because this is a story which is exactly to the point. She said, well, I'm not going to hold government bonds anymore. I'm not going to be subject to inflation risk.
Yeah.
I'm going to go short. I'm going to hold certificates of deposit at reputable banks. And I'm going to have these things mature every couple of years or so, and I'm going to be protected against long-term investments like government bonds, which would wipe me out. And what happened to her? My mother was subject to what I'm calling interest rate risk. She's now having to earn virtually nothing on her lifetime savings because interest rates are low or zero.
Yeah.
So my point here is that the government policy has whipsawed people like my mother and father, and I'm very sympathetic to what people are saying as they call into this show. And if I will, in a few minutes, I'd like you to give me a chance to say what I would propose as a solution to this.
Stand by, and we will do that. I want to get a little report on the housing front, too, because, of course, interest rates have a huge impact there. Susan Wachter joins us right now from Philadelphia, professor of finance and real estate at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. Susan, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
So we know that we had a terrible bust in a housing bubble and that we could have another big round of foreclosures if we're not careful. What are you looking at as the Fed begins to tinker with interest rates here and the American housing market's potential consequences?
Well, the Fed is signaling that it's not going to be easy money forever for the long run, but this increase in the discount rate is small and it is not likely at this point to impact the consumer. Not to say that this isn't going to eventually impact the consumer in years ahead. And it's a good thing it's not impacting the housing market because the housing market is, let's put it this way, teetering on stability. It is hopefully stabilizing. There are signs of stabilization, but the stabilization is absolutely vulnerable to further declines in the economy, and it's not a recovery that's in the bag. It's one that we have to watch.
So as you look at the Fed then, and it's thinking about interest rates, is the Fed itself being held hostage by a wobbly housing market that if it jacks up interest rates could go back in the tank, a lot more foreclosures and everything that comes with that?
Well, that's one interpretation, and certainly that's a concern to watch. But there also, of course, unemployment is high and rising still. So, held hostage, yes, there's that. But the other side of it is, and this is a very fortunate thing, that inflation has not reappeared. So as long as we have price increases were zero most recently in the CPI. So this is a sign of an economy that is not strong, and therefore it's appropriate not to impose monetary stringency at this moment.
When you look at the economy, the housing market, and interest rates, how soon does your gut tell you the Fed could start putting a significant little bump in those interest rates, up from near zero now for the federal funds rate to, 1, 2, 3 higher? I mean, I remember in the early 80s when it was 17%, 18%, 19%. When do you think, Susan, the Fed might be able to get back into those bump it up waters?
Well, focusing on the housing market, while stabilization appears to be with us, it's going to take a while for that stabilization to firm up. It'll take perhaps 6 months, and it's very dependent on what happens to unemployment. The consensus unemployment is going to peak and start declining within 6 months. So the housing market is likely to strengthen after that. We're talking a year out.
Marvin, are you comfortable waiting a year for the Fed to bump it up a little more, or does that get you into inflation worry territory?
No, I'm more or less on board with the way the conversation has been going and what Susan is saying. What I think needs to have happen is the unemployment rate needs to statistically show some evidence of retreating a percentage point or so, and then the Fed needs to act, I believe. It cannot wait. The Fed cannot wait, I think, until unemployment gets back to a normal range. That's the critical thing. But it does need to wait, I think, until the unemployment rate statistically begins to fall in a trend-like way.
And Susan, we've just got you for half a minute here, but you're still pretty worried about the housing market. Then what about foreclosures? What do you foresee there?
Well, the foreclosures is a potentially ticking time bomb, which hopefully will not go off. It's a potentially 3 million homes out there, and it's a shadow supply.
More homes that could go that way.
Could devastate the housing market and then the banking system and then the credit system, which is where we were. I think at this point it's certainly not something that is likely development. It's a risk. As long as prices continue to stabilize and increase over time, single digit, I don't expect double digit until the economy firms considerably, we can get out of this slowly. But, we have a lot of policies in place already to deal with foreclosure, and they're simply not working.
So what's your confidence level, Susan, that we're out of the double-dip recession risk zone?
I don't see that as of now. But on the other hand, the risk is high through the foreclosure problem. On the other hand, we could slowly grow out of this. That's not a pretty picture, because slow growth is slow, and that's really as good as it gets right now.
Susan Wachter at the Wharton School in Philadelphia, thank you for joining us, Susan.
Pleasure.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the economy and interest rates and the path we're on now. We're going to hear from a little later in this hour from former U.S. Senator Alan Simpson, who's just been named by President Obama to co-chair a new panel on debt and deficit. So stand by for that. Peter Coy is with us right now from New York and Bloomberg Businessweek. Marvin Goodfriend with us from Pittsburgh and the Tepper School of Business at Carnegie Mellon. Let's get a call from Morrisville, Vermont, and Hank. Hi, Hank. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm a small business owner who purchased a business about a year and a half ago, and I got, I believe, a 1.5 above prime rate, and now with the interest rates that dip so low, they try to refinance, and they want to charge 3.5% above prime. So the banks really aren't playing. With people are in hard times, For insufficient funds, they're charging $30 and not even cashing the checks.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's ridiculous. You know, just about a year ago, if someone had insufficient funds, they were charging $17.50.
So you're able to get a loan at least, but it looks like they're charging more than the economy suggests they should be.
Exactly, yeah. If I were to refinance, I'd be paying more than I did a year and a half ago.
Well, Peter Coy, what do you say to Hank?
I feel bad. I mean, the banks have really screwed up here. First of all, they made really bad lending decisions, and now they've prostrated themselves, begging for help from the government to get them out of this mess, which the government is giving. That's part of the low rates are to make it easy for banks to earn net interest margin, you know, get funds in cheap from the deposits and then lend them out at a higher rate on mortgages and so on. You know, there's a really interesting speech given by Donald Cohn. He's a member of the board of the Federal Reserve. And he was saying that banks are setting themselves up for another big mess here, or they might be if they're not careful, because the shape of the yield curve can change. You know, right now they're earning that big fat spread between their cost of funds and what they can earn on their funds.
Mm-hmm.
But that could change if short-term interest rates start to go up or long-term interest rates start to go down. They could be in a world of hurt real soon. They're trying to make it up also on the fees. But to me, that's kind of unconscionable for the reason that the Vermont caller just said. I mean, it's just like exploiting people who have no other choice to dig themselves out of the financial mess they've gotten themselves into. And one last thing I want to say. There was a great article in the New York Times over the weekend about the Canadian banks come through this quite well. And the last quote of the story was from one of them who said, you know, being a bank is like one of the greatest money-making machines known in the history of man, just as long as you don't make stupid mistakes.
Oops. But we
well,
did.
That's what they did. They made stupid mistakes.
But we did. Marvin Goodfriend, I want to hear you on that, but let me get another caller first. Tracy in Hamilton, Massachusetts. Tracy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask your panel if they would consider the idea that maybe some of these moves to lower interest rates dramatically don't work as well in this cycle as they have in previous cycles. Because if you think about it, lowering rates quickly, giving quick tax cuts to stimulate consumer spending, so much of what the consumer buys at the margin now in the way of goods is made abroad. So you stimulate the economy, but you don't stimulate or you stimulate spending, but not it doesn't flow through as it used to jobs that are here. That's my first question. And my second comment, really, is something my husband, who was a small businessman for years, we are now both retired, but he always tells me, if people are confident that they will borrow at 6% if they think the return on their investment will be 9 or 10%.
Mm, sure.
So low rates in the absence of confidence don't really do it anyway, and they do penalize savers terribly. And finally, one other last thing, because you mentioned Alan Simpson coming on later or whatever.
Couple of
one
minutes.
One of your panelists had said that, you know, one of the ways you can get not be so vulnerable to the short-term rates is to go into fixed annuities and government bonds.
Right.
However, as we're all hearing that they're running the printing presses and, you know,
$2 trillion
is worth nothing. Mm. You know, some of us are being told by our investment advisors, for God's sakes, don't go long here. And, you know, we're thinking of things like, Greece right now and the Weimar Republic, et cetera. So the point is, there's just so much structural change that doesn't ever seem to come up in these discussions, and the possibility that things that have been right for many cycles and are kind of, you know, received theory in the economic textbooks may not work today.
Well, Tracy, that's great. You put us right on that right here, right now, and we're glad for that. Marvin, let me throw all that to you and finally come to your solutions, because Tracy's looking at your advice to go long, invest in long-term annuities and bonds and Greece and inflation and a little concerned about that even. But start at the beginning with Tracy. She says, you know, does stimulation work when the manufacturing is done elsewhere? If people don't have the confidence, no matter what the interest rate is, they're not going to dive in.
I very much like what Tracy said in a lot of ways. And let me start off mm-hmm. with the first point, but then I want to come to her last point, which mm-hmm. which really gets me back to my solution, mm-hmm. so-called.
Good.
First point is, yes, low rates are not working as well as they had been in the past, in part because in the past we had high rates of inflation and we could move rates down to negative real interest rates to reconnect with something we said at the very beginning of the hour. When the Fed was running inflation at 10%, you know, in the bad old days mm-hmm. of the so-called great inflation of the 1970s and 80s, we don't want to go back there. Nevertheless, when inflation was 10%, the Fed moved and did move rates down to 5 and 4 and had a negative 6% borrowing cost.
That's a lot of leverage. That's
a lot of leverage. And so Tracy is absolutely right. With respect to interest rate policy, one of the I don't want to say better things of the bad old days was that the Fed interest rate policy had a much bigger kick. Mm-hmm. We don't have that now. And she's absolutely right to make that point. But I want to come back to her point about people are telling her, you know, not to go long.
And but which for the non-investor class means don't get into long-term investments. Why? Because they may look good now, but if inflation is, you know, 10%, yes, they won't look good.
Exactly. If inflation goes up to 10%, then the real value of these instruments will be disintegrated as they were in my father's case, as mm-hmm. I was talking about a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Now, here's what we have is a very, very uncomfortable situation, an awful situation, actually, in which average people have nowhere to go. I completely agree with Tracy. And the way I look at this, there's really only one way to solve this problem, and it's this. Historically, you know, long-term government bonds in the United States, say in the 50s and 60s before inflation, they paid about 4.5 percentage points year in, year out, mm-hmm. and inflation was 1%. So these long-term government bonds back then yielded 3% essentially riskless return.
Right, right.
That's a pretty nice return to have year in, year out, without worrying about anything, without having to go mm-hmm. to a fancy financial yep. market wizard to get you into an annuity. What the government needs to do is to go back. And by the way, there are plenty of government bonds out there to buy. God knows, too many. Mm-hmm. But people are afraid because the government is not committing to stabilize the inflation rate over the next 20 or 30 years.
So what should happen?
Well, the government, it seems to me, has to give people a safe harbor for their longer-term retirement funds.
Inflation-protected.
Inflation-protected that keeps them away from having short-term assets which are subject to this interest rate problem that we've been talking about.
So you're talking about some kind of new implement here, some kind of new, I don't know, investment option.
It's not really new. The government needs to commit to stabilizing the purchasing power of its currency to stabilize inflation.
Well, how do you do that while you're shoveling $2 trillion out the window?
Well, we're shoveling $2 trillion out the window now because we have a 10% unemployment rate yep. and we're trying yep. to hold off deflation.
Right.
This is getting confusing, I know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the Fed can do both. The country can do both. The country can let the Fed act to stimulate the economy this year and commit to letting the Fed raise rates as need be sometime next year, as we've been discussing,
mm-hmm.
to hold the line on the inflation premium that markets will demand in the long-term government bonds. So we can stabilize the long-term interest rates and give people some confidence that they can hold on to these things and get some real return mm-hmm. on their lifetime assets. In other words, just to summarize, we want to provide a safe harbor so that people are not subject to low short-term interest rates having denuded their assets of income and yet are not killed by inflation on the long end. I mean, in a way,
because
the government has whipsawed the public, the general public, they have nowhere to go, and they're being forced into the arms of unscrupulous financial market people.
Risky stuff.
So, you know, there is a solution, and it requires some discipline on our fiscal policy.
Peter Coy, we've just got half a minute here before we go to Alan Simpson. Do you see the Fed's little move last week as a signal that they're headed in that direction of, you know, some kind of ironclad guarantee, we will stay on top of inflation, Germany style?
Well, they've been intent on that for years now, and that's Ben Bernanke needs to retain the confidence, which I think right now he does have, of the market that it won't let inflation get out of control. That's essential, so I agree with Professor Goodfriend on that.
Well, that's a point of agreement in a sea that looks pretty tough for individuals to navigate right now. We're grateful to each of you for helping us get some insight into it. Peter Coy at Bloomberg Businessweek in New York. Peter, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
And Marvin Goodfriend at the Tepper School of Business, Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. Professor Goodfriend, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
In a moment, President Obama sets up a deficit panel without help from the Hill. This is On Point. The U.S. Senate declined to form a panel to take on the U.S. deficit, so last Thursday, President Obama created one himself. He signed an executive order to create a bipartisan commission on fiscal responsibility and reform. It will be co-chaired by former President Clinton's chief of staff, Erskine Bowles, and former Republican Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming. The president laid out a tough assignment.
Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles are taking on the impossible. They're going to try to restore reason to the fiscal debate and come up with answers as co-chairs of the new National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. I'm asking them to produce clear recommendations on how to cover the costs of all federal programs by 2015.
The president on his assignment, and it sounds tough. Joining me now from Cody, Wyoming, is the panel's co-chair, Alan Simpson. Senator Simpson, welcome to the program.
Hi there, Tom. How are you today? How are you?
We're pretty good, but I wonder about you. President Obama says you're taking on the impossible. What are you getting into here?
Well, it's a suicide mission, and I'm still goofy enough to do those things. The cry went up immediately from, I don't know, I can't name all the sources that'll be after our fanny, but the cry went up, a stalking horse for taxes. Let me tell you, gang, I'm a stalking horse for my grandchildren, and when I got in touch with Erskine Bowles, who's a splendid man, he has 7 grandchildren. I have 6.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, those little kiddies will be picking grit with the chickens in 30 years unless we do something. It's no time for charts or analysis and all the rest of it. It's a very simple thing. Everything you love in discretionary spending for the kids, the old, the mm-hmm. heather, the whatever, the mm-hmm. whatever, won't be there because there's an engine coming down the track with no brakes whatsoever, and it's called the entitlements, and it's called Social Security, and it's called Medicare. And you can blink and snort and grunt and do all sorts of tricks, and you will not escape the fact that that will suck up everything and squeeze everything you care about. Now, that's the way it is.
Senator Simpson, tell us, what's the structure of this panel, then, that you're going to co-chair with Erskine Bowles? Who will be on it? Or are there reserve seats? What's it look like?
Reserve seats. No one wants a reserve seat. They've sold their tickets. And
run.
There were no scalpers. There wasn't a person to buy them. It's 6 in each house. 3 from the majority of the House, 3 from the minority of the House, mm-hmm. 3 from the majority of the Senate, 3 from the minority of the Senate, and 6 selected by the President. Of those 6, Erskine and I are 1 and 2. He's got 4 more picks.
Okay.
He's got 1 more pick for Republican and 3 for Democrats, so the composition, which has been agreed to in the first package that failed, is 10-8. So there are 18 people ready to join hands, go off the cliff, and lose
so,
their life.
So 18 in total, you've got to have 14 votes on your final recommendations.
That is correct, and so that gives heart to the Republicans if they all decide to, you know, just blast away. 14 of the 18 must come to the conclusions that we present by December 1st. Obviously, we can't present anything before the election or we'll...
Yeah.
You
know, nobody will step up. You were joking, but are you having trouble filling out the panel? Do people want to serve on this, or you got to, you know, lasso them?
No. There are indeed people who want to serve, but of course the Republicans at first were reticent to join in any panel, but I will say that John Boehner, the minority leader in the House, and Mitch McConnell in the Senate have both concurred, gladly so, to appoint. And I believe the appointment might have been made by the mm-hmm. Democrats in the Senate. And if the ones I've heard of are the 3, Max Baucus, who came to the Senate when I did, a delightful fellow, a great mm-hmm. friend of mine, and Conrad, Kent Conrad. You can't leave Conrad off of this, and Greg, because Conrad the Democrat, Jim
yeah.
Greg the Republican, put up the first package.
Right.
It got 53 votes, but 7 of the co-sponsors voted against it at the time, or that would have been the 60 votes to carry it. So that was done for reasons unknown to this poor peon here in the Wild West, but it was done. And now we got to undone it.
We've got one more minute with you, Senator. I want to ask you then, are you saying that you're going in presuming we have to cut Social Security, cut Medicare? Well, what about raise taxes? What's the balance?
See, those are the wonderful flash words that go with this. This is bigger than those things.
Mm-hmm.
This is everything is on the table. Everything, including everything the president loved. This is the worst situation that this country has ever faced, and all you have to do is what your gentlemen were talking about before, $1.6 trillion deficit this year, spreading to trillions on out into the future. Look, you can do things. You can raise the retirement age on Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
You can deal with a system that was set up in 37 when it was averaged, the rate of death was 57%, so that's why they set the retirement at 65.
Yep.
You can do things here without cremating. And let me tell you, the last time in this last 1 minute, well, no, half a second, everything we tried last time with Social Security had nothing and no effect on anyone over 60. And guess who raised hell? Everybody over 60. Now, that was every single thing that was proposed the last time under any president never affected anyone over 60, and the hue and cry from the senior organizations was disgusting, to say the least.
Well, everything on the table, and former Senator Alan Simpson thinking about his grandchildren, maybe a lot of other grandchildren. Senator, thank you very much for joining us today.
Pleasure. You betcha.
Senator Alan Simpson, co-chair of the new Obama Commission on the Deficit. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.